I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Last month, EPA Administrator Michael Regan announced a, quote, strategic roadmap to regulate PFAS. These are toxic chemicals that have contaminated drinking water in many parts of the country and can be found in products we use every day.
Enough is enough. It's time that we prioritize the American people's health over profits of big polluters. I want to go as far and as fast as we can to keep our families safe from these toxic chemicals.
PFAS are human-made compounds that don't break down naturally, earning the name forever chemicals, and pose a threat to public health. They have been made for decades by petrochemical companies and can be found in things like dental floss and makeup, nonstick cookware, clothing, firefighting foam, cleaning supplies. It's a very long list. Today on Radio Times, what you need to know about PFAS and the EPA plans to regulate them. We have two guests who have joined us. Carla Ng joins us by Skype. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Pittsburgh. Carla Ng, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Scott Faber, Vice President of Governmental Affairs at the Environmental Working Group. And Scott Faber, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be with you.
In fact, Scott, let me begin with you. I feel the need for some definitions before we get into what the EPA wants to do. When we talk about PFAS as forever chemicals, what does that mean?
Yeah, so PFAS are a class of chemicals that are characterized by their carbon-fluorine bond, a chemical bond that makes them virtually impossible to break down, and that's why they're called forever chemicals. They not only last a really, really long time when they're released into the environment, they also last a long time when they enter your bodies, and that is one of the reasons that they're linked to very serious health problems.
I want to pick up on that too, Carla Ng. When we talk about PFAS, we're really talking about, what, thousands of chemical compounds.
That's right. And there are all sorts of different numbers you can find online. So they range from descriptions of hundreds of chemicals to thousands of chemicals. And we know that there are probably about 1,000 of them that you can find on registries and in commerce, but also that some of them do partially break down into other substances. And so if you look at the whole universe of PFAS, you can get many thousands of different chemicals that are all related by sharing that carbon-fluorine bond.
And does the EPA want to regulate all of them, or have they targeted several of these compounds?
So I think it's well understood that PFAS as a class are problematic because all of them have this very high persistence as a characteristic. I think that what EPA has done so far is to try to address the most problematic first. And of course, that began with PFOA and PFOS, the two 8-carbon PFAS. Because they were discovered to be both bioaccumulative and toxic. And now that has expanded as we learn more and more about the emerging or newer PFAS. And so I think that that net is getting wider and wider as we learn more about these chemicals.
Scott Faber, going back to you, and in my introduction, I listed some of the everyday products that we use. It is a very long list. I didn't include everything. Help us understand why that has been such a popular use of these chemical compounds.
Yeah. So PFAS are remarkable if you are worried about having clothes or carpets that are stain resistant, if you want to put out jet fuel fires. They have a lot of industrial applications. Some of these uses, to use the academic term, are really dumb. There's really no good reason.
Really dumb, you said. Go
really
ahead.
Really dumb, as I think Carla would back me up on that. And there are just some uses of PFAS in cosmetics and cleaning products and food packaging that I think meet the academic definition of really dumb and also just unnecessary. There are safer chemical alternatives in the marketplace.
But what are they there allegedly to do?
Well, it depends on the use. So, for example, we use PFAS in your mascara and eyeliners to make them waterproof. We use PFAS in food packaging to make our food packaging grease resistant. They have a lot of different uses depending on the use in the particular product. The good news is most of those users are really non-essential. There are better chemicals that we can use and still have clothes that don't get stained or carpets that don't get stained, have frying pans that don't stick. And And it's just inertia, especially on the part of government, that has led to us unknowingly and without our consent bringing toxic forever chemicals into our homes.
Carla, dumb and toxic.
Yeah, and I think Scott gave me a perfect intro there to talk about this concept of when chemicals are needed or not. And I think that is a really powerful concept to think about as we start to consider regulating these chemicals. I was co-author in a study called the concept of non-essential use for phasing out PFAS. And basically, if you know that it is an application of a compound that has hazardous properties, but is not a necessary application, there should be no, it's a no-brainer, right? That is an easy use to get rid of.
Its durability, as I understand it, as a completely non-scientist part of this conversation, I'll go back to you, Carla Ng. I mean, its durability, I guess, has been the selling point.
It has, and we should bring in here that there are also uses for which that durability is very important, right? So in addition to a lot of these consumer-facing uses, PFAS are also used in a lot of industrial applications. And so industrial applications in which they, you know, the systems are subject to a lot of high heat or pressure or acidic conditions, those harsh conditions often require a chemical that is able to withstand them. And this is why PFAS has seen such wide use in those areas. But that is precisely why they're so problematic once they're in the environment.
And so the focus is really on the consumer use of PFAS, Carla?
I think it's all uses. So if you look at the new EPA strategic roadmap, they mentioned the life cycle of PFAS, and that includes upstream and downstream. And so any use that will result in the release of these chemicals to the environment is problematic. And so if you think about from the consumer side, that's very concerning because it's a lot of very widespread diffuse uses. So lots of opportunities for PFAS to enter the environment through wastewater, through landfills. But also in industrial uses, we've seen a lot of communities that are contaminated by direct releases. And so those upstream uses also need to be at least contained, if not removed entirely.
Let me play a TV commercial. This actually goes back to 1952, featuring DuPont Company's Larry Livingston. And he's introducing a brand new product, and it is called Teflon.
I'm Larry Livingston of the DuPont Company. This story is about a new plastic material trademarked Teflon. Oh, it has another great jaw-breaking chemical name, tetrafluoroethylene resin. It might be described as a really heavy-duty plastic. It is not affected by acids and alkalis. It even withstands the acid that is used to dissolve gold and platinum. It withstands a lot of heat and cold, too. It is really a tough guy among plastics.
Scott Faber, did they anticipate or even have any inkling that there could be a toxic reaction to these PFAS?
Yeah, what's so sad about that ad is just about that same time that Larry was reading that advertisement, DuPont and other companies knew even then that PFAS were binding to our blood proteins. They knew by the 60s that it was toxic. They knew by the 70s that it was poisoning their own workers, and by the 80s that it was poisoning their neighbors. But not only did they keep making these very toxic forever chemicals, they didn't tell anyone. They didn't tell their neighbors. They didn't tell their workers. They didn't tell the EPA, leading to, at the time, the biggest fine in American history. So it's so sad to hear that advertisement, because maybe Larry didn't know, but certainly other people at DuPont at that time knew.
Carla, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I also, you know, PFAS have gotten a lot of attention, and I think they should have a lot of attention, but they're also very emblematic of a failure for us to learn a lesson, right? This is not the first very persistent chemical we've dealt with that we are still dealing with. If you look back at the story about PCBs, if you look back at the story about DDT, it comes up again and again. And so we kind of know what's going to happen, and yet we persist in ignoring the clues.
Let me go back to you, Carla Ng, and I'm thinking of people listening to our conversation and being alarmed and being concerned that if it's in everyday products, and we've mentioned some of them, I think most people listening have, you know, either used them or have had some kind of interaction with these products. Carla, if you look on a label, can you see something that would say this is a PFAS?
Rarely.
Really?
So
rarely.
Well, there are. You have to know something about brand names, or you'll have to know some of the other ways that they're called. So you might see things that are labeled as having Teflon, right? That's one of the most well-known ones. But you may have something, for example, that mentioned it has a fluoroacrylate polymer or something else in there. So you know that there's something that was made with PFAS to make that ingredient. And so one of the things that really disturbs me about the way that we use chemicals right now is that you basically have to be a chemist to try and track these things down. It's not clear. Things are not labeled clearly. And even people who produce certain products that turn out to have PFAS in them do not know that their products contain PFAS.
Why not?
Because there's such lack of transparency in the supply chain. And Scott, so it may have been used somewhere, you know, earlier.
Sure. I mean, Scott, I think we're all aware of the name Teflon. Are you both saying don't use Teflon?
Well, I think what's so ridiculous about this is that people shouldn't have to be toxicologists to sort of shop their way around the problem. And, you know, and as Carla said, there are brands that are making PFAS-free goods. You can find lists on EWG's website or the website of the Green Science Policy Institute. So you can, in some respects, shop around this problem. But isn't it crazy that we live in a world where consumers are expected to solve this problem rather than having the government promulgate, first and foremost, a trustworthy PFAS-free label, but more importantly, just getting the stuff out of the things we're bringing into our homes, and especially when there's no reason to have PFAS in our food packaging and cosmetics and other everyday products.
We're almost up on a break here. And Carla, I know you warned us that your cats were going to be making noises at your door. I just want to say to our listeners that we can hear them and it's perfectly fine. But let me ask you just quickly on this EPA announcement, does that take a step into addressing this problem of PFAS?
I think it's important. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, if you're speaking about the roadmap specifically, I think that it's absolutely necessary. What's still not known is how quickly those steps are going to be taken.
And you say urgency is really critical at this point?
Yes, absolutely. Because of their persistence, every kilogram of PFAS that goes out there is going to be with us for a really long time.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about PFAS, and these are called forever chemicals, as our guests have been saying. They don't break down naturally. They don't break down in our bodies. They have been linked to health problems. They're found in things like drinking water and, as we are learning, in everyday products. You can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, you can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call us, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And again, talking with Carla Ng, she's assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering. That's at the University of Pittsburgh, across the state here from us here in Philadelphia. Scott Faber, vice president of governmental affairs at the Environmental Working Group. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we are talking about PFAS and the EPA's roadmap to address the environmental and health threats from these toxic chemicals. Let me play one more clip from EPA Administrator Michael Regan, where he's laying out the first part of the agency's PFAS roadmap plan.
First, we're announcing a national testing strategy that forces PFAS manufacturers, from Chemours to 3M, to disclose in great detail just how toxic these chemicals are. It would take EPA decades to do this on our own, at the expense of American families and the American taxpayer, but instead, the polluters who are poisoning our nation's waterways will be responsible for conducting and paying for this work.
Scott Faber, help us understand what the administrator is saying there, and is this an important first step?
Well, it's certainly a first step, and it's certainly long overdue. EPA has known about these risks since at least 1998, and has done literally nothing. And so it's certainly good news to the communities that are thousands of communities with contaminated water who are downwind or downstream of these polluters. I think where the administrator and the administration missed an opportunity was to do what Administrator Regan seemed to say we should do, which is we should make sure the polluters are doing their part. And in particular, we should be making sure that we're not discharging more and more PFAS into the air and water from manufacturing facilities. We estimate there are about 30,000 companies of all kinds that could be dumping PFAS into rivers or pumping PFAS into the air. And while there are certainly some good first steps taken in the roadmap, there are no hard deadlines to limit the amount of PFAS that's being pumped into the air and water from industry. And if you're living downwind or downstream of these industrial sites or these manufacturers and you've been waiting decades for EPA to act, you're not very excited about this roadmap.
And when you talk about our water supply, I'm assuming we're talking about drinking water. How many Americans do you think are drinking PFAS contaminated water?
Well, we know because the government, federal and state governments have tested drinking water for PFAS. We know that so far there are nearly 3,000 communities that have PFAS in their drinking water, but there are likely thousands and thousands more. And we don't know simply because we haven't looked. We estimate there are about 200 million Americans who are probably drinking PFAS in their tap water, but we haven't looked. And what's good about the roadmap is that the administrator and his team will, by 2023, set a tap water standard for the two best understood, most notorious PFAS, PFOS and PFOA. So that's good news. What's disappointing about that is that the costs of all of cleaner water will simply fall on all of us because we'll pay for that in higher water bills. And none of those costs will fall on industry who can keep dumping their PFAS wastes into our drinking water supplies, which no one seems to think is a good idea.
Let me go to you, Carla Ng. We're in Pennsylvania. You're in Pittsburgh. I'm in Philadelphia. When you look at drinking water in the state, are there certain parts of Pennsylvania that are more at risk for PFAS?
Yes, unfortunately, where you are is in worse shape than where I am. So areas near Philadelphia have known contamination where there are high levels of PFAS in the drinking water. In Pittsburgh, this is not a known problem, although we recently had an issue in McKeesport, not far from where I am, where they were having a fire that for some reason the local fire authority was using PFAS-containing foam.
Oh, wow.
And there was a malfunction in their equipment that caused that foam to back up into the hydrant and into the water system. So when you have PFAS on hand, these sorts of things happen. And leads to pretty serious contamination issues.
And Carla, you were mentioning around Philadelphia some of these former military bases, and that's been a site for a lot of this contamination.
That's right. So again, this is associated with the use of this PFAS-containing foam, and that really is one of the most direct ways to get PFAS into your water, is to use it to both fight fires and for firefighter training, which it used to be used a lot for, where you're basically spraying foam, onto the environment and then washing it away. And so, of course, that winds up in both surface and groundwater over time.
Are there any safe levels, Carla Ng, for PFAS?
That is a difficult question to answer. For the PFAS, which have been linked to cancers, there is an understanding that there's no safe level of exposure to cancer-causing substances because each exposure can contribute to your chance of developing cancer. And so for the long-chain PFAS like PFOA and PFOS, there are concerns that it's difficult to say that there is a safe level. And one of the concerns we have in general about this class is the more we research about them, the more we find important effects at very, very low concentrations. So, people are sometimes surprised by these water limits that are health advisory levels that are set for different states that are down at the part per trillion level. That's really tiny. But even at those low concentrations, you can start to see effects on things like reduced immune response to vaccines. And so that's concerning.
Indeed. I mean, concerning, obviously, because we're in the throes of a COVID epidemic. Scott Faber, let me go back to you. And you mentioned in the air. Does that mean how do some of these chemicals get into the air? Is it because it's being burnt or somehow exhausted into the air?
Yeah. So as Carla said, PFAS are used in lots of industrial applications, and as they're used, they are sent up through the stacks of manufacturers of all different kinds of things, including everything from rugs to upholstered furniture to electrical components, textiles. So they are just like other wastes that those companies might send into the air. PFAS is sent up into the air. What's different about PFAS is there are no legal limits. So while most of the contaminants that a big company might send up into the air and into the water are subject to numerical limits set under our Clean Air Act or Clean Water Act, there are no such limits for PFAS, which strikes probably most people living downwind of those releases as kind of crazy. The other piece that is in the roadmap that's important to note, though, especially for folks in living near Willow Grove, is that the administration will move ahead with designating PFOA and PFOS as hazardous substances under our nation's primary cleanup law, the Superfund law. That's really important because it will really accelerate the cleanup process at places like Willow Grove and Horsham, the former Horsham Air Force Base. And it will ensure that polluters help pay for some of those cleanup costs. So I know that's a big issue in the Philadelphia area.
Absolutely, yeah, just in the collar counties around Philadelphia. Actually, let me get Bernie, who's calling us from New Jersey. He worked with Teflon back in the 1950s with a processing company. And Bernie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Go ahead. What's your comment?
Well, my comment is, I got out of high school, and I got a job at a place called U.S. Gasket in Camden, New Jersey. And Teflon was fairly new at that time. And these big drums, which come through with 220 pounds of powder from, totally white powder from DuPont to be kept clean, et cetera, et cetera. And we would take this and put it now, like I said, the company I worked for, tore the labels off the drums about when being heated above 500 degrees Fahrenheit, it produced hazardous fumes. Well, we use the word cooked this stuff at 690 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
And depending on the density, the thickness, the walls of this stuff and so forth, determine how long it would be stuffed in an oven at 690 degrees. And then we would take it out and put it under pressure until it totally cooled down. Then we would remove it from the molds, and there would be orders, and it was described as a miracle substance for bearings and things like that where they couldn't use steel. And, at any rate, I'm 90 years old.
You're still here.
I don't think I'm senile.
No, I don't think you are either. Bernie, no, I really appreciate the call because you're telling us things that only you know. And let me give Carla Ng a chance to respond. He worked in this factory in Camden. They got these big barrels of Teflon, not supposed to be heated above 500 degrees, according to Bernie. The labels were removed. It was cooked up to 690 degrees, and then the products made. What does that tell us, Carla Ng?
Yeah, it tells us a few things. It tells us that companies are not responsible for the health of their workers as much as they should be, and that's really tragic. It also tells us that we, because of this lack of care, we don't really know what the entire contamination profile across the different industries that use these substances is, and it's likely a much wider problem than we think.
Do you want to add to that, Scott Faber? And I know from some of the research from your environmental working group that, and I'm scrambling here, 30,000 industrial sites suspected industrial discharge.
Yeah, thank you, Bernie, for calling. It's really really terrible story. And I think in addition to having no limits on how much PFAS can be in water or how much PFAS can be discharged by industry into the water or into the air, or no rules on how PFAS waste should be disposed, whether they should be incinerated or put in a landfill or not, there are also no rules to protect workers. So that, you know, that should trouble all of us, that there are thousands of people who are handling PFAS even today in industrial settings, and the OSHA has really failed to step forward and protect them. That's especially true for firefighters. Firefighters are especially vulnerable to PFAS. It's not only in the foam, as we heard from Carla, that they use to put out certain kinds of fires. It's also in their gear, in their turnout gear. And it turns out that PFAS in turnout gear may be one of the ways that so many firefighters are ultimately getting cancer. So this is a big problem. It needs a whole of government approach that protects consumers, that protects our drinking water, that protects our workers. Unfortunately, the roadmap from the Biden administration, while certainly better than past efforts and certainly includes some important first step, doesn't go nearly far enough.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We've got a lot of people with some questions. That's Scott Faber. He's Vice President of Governmental Affairs at the Environmental Working Group. Also with us, Carla Ng, and she's an assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Pittsburgh. We are talking about these toxic chemicals, PFAS, that are in many everyday products. A question to you, Carla. I'm curious about what health risks are associated. I heard both you and Scott talk about cancer. Are there certain kinds of cancers and what else?
Yeah, so in terms of the ones that are best established for the well-studied PFAS, we know that they're linked with kidney cancer, testicular cancer, and liver damage, although liver cancer has not been quite linked. There is some evidence that there might be links to breast cancer as well. They're linked to thyroid disease. They are linked to an overall disruption of our lipid metabolism that causes higher levels of cholesterol to circulate in the blood. And as I mentioned before, one of the more sensitive effects is an immune toxicity that causes reduced response to vaccines.
How about effect on developing fetuses?
Also, that's right. Lower birth weight has been known, and also some reproductive effects. So early puberty onset, increased miscarriage risk, increased time to pregnancy. Quite a number. One of the things that is disturbing about PFAS is just the wide range of biological effects they seem to have.
Indeed. Here's a question from Marisol. Should I feel comforted or not if something says BPA free? Scott Faber, can I toss that to you? Go ahead.
Yeah, well,
we've done shows on BPA. Yeah, no, go ahead.
No, it's a great question. And it goes back to some of the misleading claims that you might see on your pans about them being PFOA free, right? So while that means that that pan may not contain PFOA or may not have been made with PFOA, it may have been made with one of the hundreds of replacement chemicals that are still parts of this PFAS class. The same is true for BPA. So while your bottle may be BPA-free, it may have other bisphenols like BPS that, as has been the case with PFAS, may pose many of the same health concerns, especially around immune system harm.
Here's a related question from Harry. What are we supposed to use instead of products that have Teflon? Or Carla, you know, I've been scribbling all the letters that you and Scott have been talking about when it comes to labels. I mean, again, what should people look for to be safe?
Right. So if you're very interested in having something that is nonstick, there are now PFAS-free alternatives. So one of the things you have to be careful of is not to go for PFOA-free or PFOS-free, but look for the whole class. There are some ceramic alternatives that are available. In my own kitchen, I use cast iron. I think it's great.
You just have to lift
forever.
It, right?
That's right. So it's a good workout at the same time.
How about for you, Scott?
Cast iron.
Cast iron,
great.
Really?
There are a lot of really terrific, if you don't like cast iron, there are a lot of great PFAS-free pans available. And again, great sources for that for your listeners. The Green Science Policy Institute, GSPI.org, has a great list of PFAS-free products by category. So if you want a raincoat that isn't made with PFAS, or you want to buy a carpet that isn't made with PFAS, You can go there. If you want to avoid PFAS in your cosmetics, I know everyone can't believe that we allow PFAS in cosmetics. And unfortunately, the FDA in that case has really failed to protect us. You know, there are, you can use our Skin Deep app to find products that are made without cosmetics. There are ways to shop around this problem. It really ought to be the government's job to get these really dumb uses of PFAS, unnecessary uses of PFAS, out of the things we bring into our homes.
Well, picking up on that, and to you, Carla Ng, I mean, we're talking about the EPA. What about the Defense Department? If we're talking about, you know, military bases or former military bases and other branches of government that should be more involved in this.
That's right. And I think that's been a big concern with the designation of PFAS as hazardous, so PFOA and PFOS, that the Department of Defense would be left with a pretty big bill to clean up all of the military sites. But this is important, and it's also important. We're talking about protecting workers. Protecting the military also should be pretty high on our priority of keeping people safe who are keeping us safe. And it's something that is going to have to be done because it's known to be a major source of this particular chemical pollution.
Is it just money? Yeah,
quick,
please do. Yeah, go ahead.
One quick thing, just if I can, Marty, is that there are now nearly 400 military bases around the country where there are giant toxic plumes of PFAS flowing into our neighboring communities, into defense communities, and the DOD, the Biden DOD, has actually proposed to spend less money to clean up those plumes. So, I couldn't agree more with Carla. We ought to do everything we can to protect our service members. They're being exposed to PFAS in ways that a lot of us are not. But we also need to protect their neighbors. The Defense Department's been kind of a crummy neighbor, and that's especially true in places like Willow Grove.
Well, we are talking about PFAS, and these are toxic chemicals used in many products that we all use, posing a risk to human health. And talking with Scott Faber, Vice President of Governmental Affairs at the Environmental Working Group. Also with us, Carla Ng, and she's an assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Pittsburgh. We've got a lot of time to talk some more, and we want to hear from you, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with our guests about what the EPA wants to do to regulate PFAS and what you should know about these toxic chemicals. They are known as forever chemicals because they don't break down naturally in the environment, apparently don't break down in our bodies either. They have been linked to health problems and are found in things like drinking water and everyday products. Let me play one more clip that we queued up. This is a commercial from 1964. Called Teflon. Why work harder advertising a range of kitchen products that are coated in Teflon?
Come here. Look at some great new products coated with DuPont Teflon. Teflon means no stick cooking, no scour cleanup with new electric fry pans. See? The egg slides right out. Cook pancakes on a Teflon-coated electric griddle. They don't stick. You'll love this Teflon-coated waffle iron. And this oven has walls lined with Teflon for easier cleaning. And Teflon makes...
I mean, Scott Faber, you know, that's the answer to everything, right? Easy cleanup.
Well, I think in the 50s, unless you knew, as DuPont and 3M and others did, that these were toxic chemicals that were going to stay in your body forever, or at least for a really long time, if you didn't know those things, this did seem like a miracle substance because it has so many great applications. Nobody wants a stain on their rug. Everyone wants their raincoat to keep them dry. It's, you know, these are great chemicals, except for the fact that they're strongly linked to cancer and make our vaccines less effective and interfere with their ability to start families. Other than those things, these are wonderful chemicals.
Here's a question from Dari. Can you discuss the transfer of PFAS into soil? We've talked about water systems, but to you, Carla Ng, how does it get into our soil?
Yes, and can I just point out the irony of the easy cleanup in that commercial?
Yes, please do.
When now we're dealing with the issue of trying to clean up this enormous PFAS
contamination. I missed that. Yes.
And that deals directly with this question about soil. So PFAS, you know, in the same way that it can get into the air, it'll settle from the air into the soil. It can be, if it's used in the firefighting foams, it not only percolates into the water, but also through the soil. And one of the means that I think surprised folks, but is turned out to be a really big deal, is the application of sludge. So sludge from either industrial wastes or wastewater treatment plants, because the PFAS in those sludges that are used to amend the soil then transfer to the soil itself and can become a decades-long headache, which has been found. For example, there was a dairy farm in Maine that had applied sludge from a paper mill decades ago, and now the dairy cattle are still too contaminated for, you know, to be able to sell the milk. So this is a long-term problem we're also going to have to deal with.
Wow. Scott, anything you want to add to that about sludge?
Yeah. No, it's a big looming problem that is not well understood. And here's why it matters, that so many farmers have used PFAS-contaminated sludge as a fertilizer. And, of course, these PFAS never break down. They stay in the soil forever. They slowly work their way up into the food that either we eat or they're used as feed for animals. And of course, we eat the animals or their products. So it's probably the case, and experts here and in Europe have found this, that you, most of your PFAS exposure is coming from your food, not from your water. One reason is because of contaminated sludge that's used as a fertilizer. The other is because the FDA allows, which also seems crazy, PFAS to be used in food packaging, which then migrates into the food we eat. So I hate to mention all this right before lunch, but one of the ways that we're getting too much PFAS into our bodies is through our diet.
Let me go back to you, Carla Ng, and then I'll read some more questions from our listeners. So if we're talking about a forever chemical that we need to get out of our bodies and our environment, how do we do that? If you don't want to burn it and you don't want to bury it, how do we get rid of this forever chemical?
Right. Let's get back to that question of urgency, right? So the first thing we absolutely have to do is stop emitting new PFAS. There's no way we're going to solve this problem if we think to ourselves, well, let's clean up, you know, the current contamination. And in the meantime, we'll wait until the new toxicity data are out before we do something about the current uses. We absolutely have to turn off the tap. But once that's done, we've got this enormous waste problem with us, right? And so there's a lot of really smart scientists working hard to try to figure out how to break down PFAS. Right now, the most surefire way we know to do it, pardon the pun, is to burn them. But that doesn't mean that there are no risks involved, because if the incineration is not done under really controlled conditions, you can wind up releasing PFAS into the air, right? So there are people working with ways to make bacteria break them down. There are people working with ways to use, you know, electrochemical and fancy materials. And that's needed, and it's really important. But this is one of those issues where I think technology is not going to save us. I'm an engineer. I would love technology to save us. But we have to contend with the fact that these chemicals are going to be with us for a really long time. And we have to think about ways to avoid exposure. Because if we look back at the stories we haven't learned very well from, so things like PCBs and DDTs, those are still with us, right? And they actually break down faster than PFAS do. So it's a long-term issue.
Well, so to avoid exposure, and if we're talking about things like everything from makeup to clothing to furniture to cleaning supplies, again, we're back to looking at labels and just avoiding them as best we can, Carla?
Well, and not using PFAS in all of those products, right? So any, as Scott said earlier, any dumb use of PFAS needs to be phased out, because it just doesn't make any sense to create such a huge environmental issue for something like eyeliner.
Right. And to go back to you, Scott Faber, I mean, is there anything in this EPA roadmap that deals with the dumb uses of PFAS as you and Carla have talked about?
No. And the primary reason is that most of the dumb uses are regulated by the FDA, not by the EPA. So big challenge for the Biden administration and for Congress is that they've so far failed to ban these dumb uses of PFAS in food packaging, cosmetics, cleaning products, carpets, clothing, etc. Some of them are regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, which is actually defending these uses of PFAS, if you can believe that. And some are regulated by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which has also been slow to address this issue. So I think that just to combat the sense of your listeners that there's of hopelessness, right, that there certainly are some things we can do. And some are coming. So one is filtering PFAS out of our water. We can do that in our own homes. Some states are setting their own PFAS drinking water standards. Pennsylvania is working on theirs. And the federal government is working on a PFAS drinking water standard. So one big route of exposure, your water, may soon have less PFAS in it, depending on where you live. Another way that we can avoid PFAS is shopping around the problem until agencies like the FDA do their job and protect us. And there are great tools on the internet available at our website, ewg.org, or at the Green Science Policy Institute's website. If you just want to avoid cosmetics and cleaners and carpets and clothes and so on made with PFAS. And if you do those things, you personally can certainly reduce the amount of PFAS that's building up in your blood.
And we'll post all those organizations on our Facebook page and website just so that make sure our listeners can have access to that information. Actually, several listeners are asking us to clarify PFAS, what that means. It's P as in Paul, F as in Frank, A as in Apple, S as in Sam. So just so when you start Googling things, those are the letters you can use. Here's an email question. Actually, someone wants to be anonymous. I work for a company in Horsham, PA. That's just outside of Philadelphia, an area with water known to be contaminated with PFAS. Two people in my department had colon cancer. Obviously can't prove the connection. Additionally, it always seems unusual that four women in my department alone have had hysterectomies, fibroids being a common problem, myself included, at the age of 38 and have consumed the water for 12 years. Are PFAS known to be related to reproductive issues like this? Carla Ng, can I toss that to you?
Yeah, so there are known impacts with reproductive issues, and you know, not specifically that I know of with incidents of hysterectomy, but you can't rule it out, and also with some bowel diseases like ulcerative colitis. This is one of the tragic things about PFAS contamination is that it's widespread, and if you know you're in an area that has contaminated water, you're always going to be asking yourself, what if, or you know, do I know what these issues are? And we need to protect people from these exposures.
Here's a question from Judy. I'll toss this to you, Scott Weber. She says, are PFAS used to line food cans for humans and pets?
Not food cans, but often used to line things like popcorn bags, pizza boxes, burrito wrappers. If you go to our website, you can find more examples of how PFAS is used in food packaging. Good question.
Here's a comment from Sarah. I lived in upstate New York at the time the Saint Gobain Chemical Company had been found to be contaminating local drinking water supplies with PFAS. Communities had to use bottled water, homeowners could not use their wells, etc., and I lived downstream from where it was all taking place. Her question is, are there any PFAS test kits available for home use? Scott, can I toss that back to you?
Yeah, so there are ways to test your water for PFAS. You can also get your blood tested for PFAS. It's a little expensive, but there are ways to figure out if you've got PFAS building up in your blood. And of course, there are tools available. You can buy a water filter that goes in your fridge or goes under your sink if you're worried about the amount of PFAS that's in your water. And depending on what state you're in, your water utility may already be required to reduce the amount of PFAS in your water.
So you can check with them and find out if they are or aren't. Yeah. Carla, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah. So I do think it's important to point out that most of those filters are fairly effective, especially for the more toxic PFAS that we know about. And also in terms of consumer power here, because I can tend to sound a little hopeless. while there isn't a lot of action happening from the government side, we know that consumer activity and consumer purchasing power has an impact on companies, right? Companies are using these chemicals because they think they can make money out of it. And so if people do change the patterns of their behavior to avoid these chemicals, there will be pressure on the industry to change how they do things as well.
Let me go back to you, Scott Faber. We were talking about the EPA roadmap to deal with PFAS. What more, you referenced this earlier, but since I'm looking at the clock here and I just want to kind of summarize sort of where we're at, so to speak, what more would you like the EPA to do?
Sure. Well, here's what's good. That by 2023, they'll set a drinking water standard for how much PFOA and PFOS can be in water, and they'll designate those two chemicals as hazardous under our national cleanup laws. Mm-hmm. What they didn't do and really need to do is, as Carla said, turn off the tap, restrict the amount of PFAS that's being dumped in our rivers or pumped into the air by thousands and thousands of companies that use PFAS to make all sorts of different kinds of products. The other thing they didn't do was just straight up ban the dumb uses of PFAS that we've talked about from things like cosmetics and cleaners and carpets and upholstered furniture. They also need to go faster, as Carla said, to figure out what to do with PFAS wastes.
Yeah.
I think it's still an open question. Should we burn them? Should we put them in a hazardous waste landfill? We need to figure that out.
And to you, Carla Ng, I'm thinking about something that was referenced earlier, the companies that either create or use these chemical compounds. Are they being held responsible for the impact of these toxic chemicals?
Yeah, largely they have not been so far. And one of the things that is mentioned in the roadmap is making the polluter pay, the polluter accountable for damages. And with PFAS, it's even difficult to say which polluter, right? Because we have companies that wind up having products that have PFAS in them. So is it those products when they're released that should be accountable for the contamination, or is it just the producers of the PFAS that went into that product? So the transparency in the chain of PFAS uses along the life cycle is really important. And then trying to link also the health damages that we're seeing in communities back to those chemical uses is going to be critical.
Here's a question from John. I'll put this to you, Scott Faber. Do you know how effective the filtering process that Horsham is using, how effective it is? Do you know?
You know, I know that the DOD across the country is using what's called granular activated carbon. It's not too different from the carbon filter that might be in your Brita filter to reduce the amount of PFAS that's being provided to service members so that it's not more than 70 parts per trillion. That's a really low number, but as Carla said, most experts think the safe level of PFAS in drinking water is actually much lower than that. What the DOD has not done, and is just frankly to the great frustration of people living near Horsham, near the former airbase there, is they've not cleaned up the toxic plume that's flowing off the base and into nearby communities. And it's just heartbreaking to hear the stories of all the folks. One of them recently testified before the Senate, who've lost loved ones, who themselves have gotten cancer because of the DOD's negligence.
Any final word from you, Carla Ng?
Yeah, I just also wanted to point out, not to be negative again, but the water is just part of the problem, right? And so doing all of these regulations to water is only going to cut off one of the lines of exposure. And it's probably not even the most important exposure for most people that are living away from military facilities. So looking at consumer products and food is going to be really important in the future.
Okay. Underlining food, of course. Carla Ng, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks.
You're welcome. And she is assistant professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Pittsburgh. And she joined us by Skype. Scott Faber, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he is vice president of governmental affairs at the Environmental Working Group. And as I mentioned earlier, we will make sure that you have access to the various organizations referenced by our guests. In fact, for more Radio Times every day, you can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at WHYY Radio Times. And again, we'll post some of that information so that you can stay safe. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.